Dr. Soon of the Harvard Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory has published key reviews of the data on climate change through history.
Today, of course, I'll be talking about facts, something about 20th century temperature change. So I'll be talking about some facts and then dangerous fiction and spin. But before that, I want to get a bit philosophical. And first of all, I wanted to thank Sally's and Professor Penner and Tom for making such a wonderful presentation, especially Sally for the great introduction to the topic, like the reality of Little Ice Age and those very warm time about 1,000 years ago, known as the medieval warm period, where you can see all sorts of culture, especially the Chinese culture, were prevailing about 1,000 years ago. And then during Little Ice Age, about 500 years ago, where we can see all sorts of superstitions, all sort of filler in terms of worsening climate condition. By the way, it also coincides with the time in which the sunspot appears to disappear, right, in the mid-17th century. Okay, that's the period for sunspot is known as the Mondo Minimum, and Sally has mentioned that I've written a book on that, and extremely proud of that, and all the credits also go to Sally, especially for giving me that, you know, and now in me that habit to read. Sally, before I went to visit Harvard and go and work over there, I never read anything. I've never read newspaper. I don't read nothing. Ever since I met Sally, I started reading really, really a lot. So with that, let me start with one of the reading assignments that Sally gave me. Basically, it's a book called Dancing Naked in the Minefield. And the author is Kerry B. Mullis. I was wondering how many of us know who Kerry Mullis is? Very good, very good. Large crowd. He's actually a chemist, a brilliant scientist, who actually, essentially, his contribution is, of course, is to give you all the DNA you can want. Okay? So he created a method in which one can make copies of DNA. Not only for humans, of course, DNA of all forms. So for that, he got half of the Nobel Prize of Chemistry in 1993. But anyway, he has a lot of good statements to make about scientific methods. One of the most beautiful one is this experiment that he talks about. It's an experiment done in the 17th century. And of course, the person that done that is Robert Boyle, which is also a great scientist, a British scientist. Essentially, he pumped air out of a jar in which you have a candle in it. So you can read for yourself that essentially the candle burns out. Okay, and then there was all this controversy, of course, about whether God was in there or not. But the issue here is, of course, it's about the scientific methods. It's about the idea of doing measurements rather than posting all these esoteric questions, including some of these questions that we will deal with, especially on CO2 effects on climate. But then, in this particular paragraph, I was caught by this sentence that Kerry Mullis somehow knew about this topic being really, really strange, especially on the issues of modeling climate. So he was really trying to hint at some of these issues that I tried to address here. Basically, to tell them, if you really cannot measure some of these things or making any accurate prediction, please, you know, try not to disturb us about this. But then we are often very much disturbed by people like this. One of these heroes in these issues, this global warming, basically cartoons, is a professor by the name of Stephen Schneider from University of Stanford. How many of us know who Stephen Schneider is? That's very good, because I really don't want to explain too much about who it is, but this is some of the statement, the most recent statement that he made in Senator McCain's hearing on climate. He essentially made all that very strong conclusion, especially on surface warming trend, which is solidly grounded, and then talking about how basically that all the temperature change that we have seen, especially over the late 20th century, meaning anything from 1980 to about 2000 onwards, is exceptional, and we have never seen it before. And then they even, instead of just the actual record, the statement that apply for the actual temperature record, instrumental temperature record of only 140 years, he sort of wanted to make the breakthrough by saying that, well, now we can prove that statement, that the temperature today is the warmest of the past 2,000 years. That is an extremely strong statement to make. And we, of course, have done a very interesting paper last year, which really, in my opinion, really conclusively make a statement that you really cannot say that. In fact, you have a lot of the counter evidence. to try to say that, well, the 20th century temperature change is really unexceptional, really nothing unusual about it. Simply because that in the past, especially a period, that a medieval warm period, that's about anywhere that you can start counting from 800 to 1300 AD. That was a time that in which one can see all over the world. Not only in China, we can see in South America, we can see in New Zealand, one can see it in Australia, one can see it in North Pole, one can see all of this information that that time was warm. And in fact, it's not only warm, it's warm relatively to the current 20th century. So that's what I'm trying to say, that some of these statements are really a bit pretentious. And of course, of that little slide about it couldn't be natural change, that all the things that we've seen in the 20th century could not be natural change, therefore it must be CO2, okay? But then, really, life is a bit less serious than that, in my opinion, these issues on global warming. If it's really true, if Professor Schneider's statement is really true, then there is this cartoon that really we could learn something from. Essentially, the cartoon is saying that, well, if you really, really seriously think that you can tie energy use to global warming, then you have a very interesting feedback. Basically, as you warm, you will use less fuel. Okay, in some sense, for a lot of living, then really, less fuel means less pollution, and then that means less global warming. And of course, this reporter that is waiting outside during a cold winter last year was asked, actually beginning of this year and also last year, the winter was extremely cold in the northeast. And then he was saying, well, you say the problem will take care of itself. But of course, essentially, is where is the problem? Okay? Okay, now let's come to the real part of my talks. I will essentially cover, like I say, I will tell you some facts. Some facts that I'm quite sure that even Stephen Schneider may not want to challenge, okay? So it's a fact that we're very firm and we know about, and then really the whole focus will be really about the fictions and the spin that actually based on a paper that we published earlier this year, actually on a Valentine's Day. And that part is really trying to, and I'll focus mainly on the 20th century temperature. I will not speak on this medieval warm period or the Little Ice Age because I felt strong, at least that the data are extremely strong to say that, well, you know, this change are real and all this reality that we know about in historical record are very, very firm, unless in the old days those guys were already knew about global warming and then they were lying about all this information that we got today. So we will focus on dangerous fiction, which is basically to make a statement that some of this statement that people claim that the 20th century warming warmth is the warmest of the past 2,000 years, the decades of 1990 was the warmest decade of the past 2,000 years, and then 1998, a single year, is the warmest of all the 2,000 years on record. And I think those are huge exaggerations, and I will show also some problems in terms of the methodology. This is not much of a technique, actually. It's really a very simple thing. It's also to talk about some of the methods in which they come about to make such a highly subjective statement. And then finally, if we do have some time, I will show you some of the very, very serious problem of spin. And of course, I also have to introduce, before I even begin this talk, is to introduce this person by the name of Michael Mann. Okay, he's a professor from University of Virginia. By the way, I'm here only to speak on the science. I really do not want to criticize him as a person, although I don't like him as a person. This is true because it's no fun to really talk bad about a person. But let me start with the very first fact that I think we all should be educated about. We should learn this about. It also take me a long time to try to learn about this whole issue, but Art Robinson essentially put it in our paper that was written in 1997. That's the one, the issues on CO2 and global warming. The basic fact is that the human amount of contribution, especially from the part where we burn the fossil fuel that was kept in geological capsule, is basically that the amount of carbon dioxide that we release is about 5 billion tons a year. Okay? That's basically what I'm speaking of the flow because that's where the thing that's really relevant. And then what is always not shown to you is basically all the large natural component of exchanges of CO2 between either from the soil and the plant to the atmosphere. That's about 120 tons, billion tons. And then from the surface ocean to the atmosphere, and then from the carbon exchange between the surface ocean and the deeper ocean, that's 95 billion tons. And then the marine biota, even the amount of the carbon get assimilated by the marine biota, it's 45 billion tons per year. So that's about nine times larger than the amount of fossil fuel that we emit to the atmosphere. But of course, the argument is that as we keep burning every year, okay, that this carbon dioxide will accumulate. Okay? And then all these natural factors are basically, they claim to be in equilibrium, meaning they can only exchange back and forth, but then you don't take nothing out, you don't take nothing in, when you mean you're in equilibrium. But the fact is that some of this research are not being done, of course, because it could easily be a disbalance of 1 year, okay, of 5 billion tons between taking in or going out. So you can easily cover for even the amount that is coming from the human factors. Okay. Now, the second facts. CO2 is called as a greenhouse gas, right? The idea is that as you add the CO2 in the air, because of its CO2, because of its infrared property, its ability to try to absorb infrared radiation. By the way, it's not only absorb, it's really also emitting. Okay, but the whole idea is that if you add this amount of CO2, you will add something like, if you double the amount in the current atmosphere, you will add something like 4 watt per meter square on global average. But this chart here is trying to tell you that if you really want to even look for that, by the way, we're not yet doubling the amount of CO2 that we added to the atmosphere. We're only like two-thirds or three-thirds of the way there. But we have not yet doubled that from the pre-industrial level. But the amount is 4 watt per meter square, but the idea is that this 4 watt to how then of course, the idea is that, well, let's go and find it. But the problem is really like searching for a needle in a haystack. Because with all the best available tools that we have, we cannot quantify all the exchanges, at least the energy budget within the Earth global system, the budget. We could not quantify anything like the transport of heat flux from in the surface ocean from equator to the pole. We cannot quantify that things up to like anything from 20 watt per meter square to 100 watt per meter square. And then for even the best system that we know how to estimate, which is basically the amount of solar radiation get reflected from Earth. Okay? That amount, we don't know the amount better than 10 watt per meter square. So we're looking at something that there is not a single system that we know how to measure that is better than 10 watt per meter square. And yet, we're trying to look for something like a 4 watt per meter square in the climate system. So you can see the task is very, very difficult, at least scientifically, if you want to know the answer. And now, this one is even a more dynamical presentation of the difficulties of finding the CO2 in this climate system. This is actually a bit of a complicated chart, but let me try to explain it. It's actually a satellite retrieval, a measurement of the net long-wave radiation that one sees at the top of the atmosphere, in the atmospheric column itself, and then at the surface. And the time period for the satellite measurement goes from anywhere from 83 to about 2001 or so, at the end of this record that they were able to do analysis on. But in case you ask yourself, how much CO2 have we added to the climate system during this period, right? And that is the size of that dot. It's 0.3 watt per meter square. And then if you remember that 4 watt per meter square, I just put it for your scale. That is how large 4 watt per meter square for this scale. And this is real measurement. That's why I'm trying to confront for you how difficult it is to find this signature. Because you can see that, especially just look at the atmosphere system. You can see from year to year, we have that large of a fluctuation of at least 16 watt per meter square. So the idea of CO2, looking for the signature of CO2, is that you will really fail terribly by looking at any instantaneous time. This is part of the reason why when you speak about temperature or you speak about any variables that you try to look for the CO2, you need to average out, you need to smooth out over a very long time scale. But at any given moment, you can't see the effects of CO2, except knowing that CO2 is here because we know how to measure amount of carbon dioxide. But then in terms of its manifestation, like how it changed into the radiative heat budget, or how it changed the wind, or how it changed the ocean current, or how it changed even the trees, we don't know. We really, it will be very, very difficult to find it because the effects is very difficult to detect by measurements. Here's another fact that we know very well of. Here, I'm showing you a plot of the quote-unquote annual global, I put a quote here, of course, for a very special reason, global surface thermometer temperature record for about 140 years ago, for about 140 years, as Stephen Schneider has stated, basically from 1856 to about 2002. I also show, in addition to that temperature curve, this is basically the global warming that they are talking about, yes? But I also show that usually that is not shown in this kind of presentation is basically the amount of area coverage by that surface thermometer station. Essentially, you have a very, very low coverage, which is only 20% of the globe, to about currently about 80% of the globe. Well, this is the curve that they never show you. Okay, of course, the problem is, of course, whether you really, really believe in this curve really representing anything about global measurements of a temperature for 140 years. I really kind of don't believe in the measurements that is from the early days. And I'll give you one very good reason why I don't believe in it. And this one, I have to borrow a chart from the distinguished professor from MIT. His name is Carl Wunsch.
Okay. Yeah, let's see. Let me just put it here.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Okay. And here, I essentially wanted to show you some of his remark. Oh, laser. No laser. Okay, here. Okay, I need laser. Well, I essentially wanted to show you the remark of how people came about making such a database. Okay? And also, of course, to show you the actual distribution of the measurements that one can do on the ocean surface. Look at how sparse the measurements is. So one can hardly call the measurement for this period to be global, right? So I do have a little problem with some of this claim about global temperature. And then, of course, 1950s and 1940s, you can see the distribution is not great either, except for some of this. The recent time is indeed that one can do much, one can have much better coverage. One can really, really be more confident of what we are measuring, okay? And then Professor Wunsch here is trying to point to the real difficulty of doing measurement in the sea surface. Okay, essentially, you have a system that basically was just using a bucket from a canvas or a metal bucket, and one pulled the water out, and then one put the thermometer in. That's as really technical as is possible to measure temperature. And then from the modern time, you started to have more sophisticated system, of course, where you have water flow through the engine intakes areas, and then you start measuring temperature from those water. This is how you get the sea surface temperature measurement. But then one should not fool oneself when, after looking at this result, to not remember that these are coming from a very, very difficult measurement that one make. Okay? And then, of course, it's very patchy. How often can you really sample the ocean temperature from here or there out in the Pacific? Okay, so the point is that the measurements and all these terms about global temperature is really not as clear or as conclusive as one would put it. But here now is the real pedagogical points that I wanted to make. I borrowed this particular quote, and I would like to read it in full because it's really, really meaningful. It's coming from a book that's published by my two Canadian colleague. His name is Christopher Essex. He's a really a very smart guy, and he's a real powerful applied mathematician. And Ross McKittrick, who is an economist from University of Guelph. And the book is called Taken by Storm. And here is essentially to try to introduce you the concept about what temperature really is. Okay, it started with a question by Ms. Runga Kuta, who's actually asking, when people talk about global warming, they say global temperature is going up. Are you saying there's no such thing as global temperature? And if there isn't, does that mean there is not global warming? So here now, a very smart professor, his name is Professor Callery, he's really asking, you ask two questions, Ms. Kuta. Is there a single temperature for the Earth, or is there really global warming? Okay. The answer to the very first question is really there's no such thing as a global temperature, precisely because there is no single temperature, okay, in this room. Or in this classroom, there is a temperature field. Temperature is a quantity known to physicists as a field quantity, okay, rather than a really simple scalar. It's a continuum of temperature, so one cannot reduce in any sensible way to one single number, global temperature. Okay? And then the really much more interesting point is basically about taking an averages and then to try to form, no matter how well you sample it, no matter how you form, you thought that, well, if you sample very, very well, then I can take an average of these things. But the idea of having a global temperature is really equivalent to this particular quote here. It's really equivalent to taking the phone number of all his colleagues in the physics department and then add them up and then compute the average and say that I got a global temperature. So it's another very good way. Actually, my good senior colleagues, friends, academician from Russia, his name is Kirill Kondratyev. He used another analogy. It's equivalent to basically trying to take the temperature of all the patients in that one hospital and then try to average them to say that you got some kind of temperature for the patients, right? No, joking aside, it's really, it tried to say that when you're dealing with a few quantity, it is that complicated. But then, of course, you will never fail to see all such concepts being introduced in very, very powerful places and really entities. How many of us, I mean, just want to make sure you know what IPCC is. IPCC is basically is a short term for Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It's a body created by the World Meteorological Organization and United Nations, yes? Just where to try to provide the most authoritative knowledge or statements on climate and climate change, okay? And this is mostly was created in the 1990s just to address the questions of the worries about the impact of CO2 on the climate system, mainly, okay? And World Meteorological Organization really has a lot more work to do, like hurricanes and all this other stuff. But the UN now is kind of taking over this issue. And they are the one that make all these very strong statements that they're very confident of. This is a statement of 20th century, you know, is won by that much, okay? And then science, of course, is about quantitative details, okay? When you say 0.6, you better make sure that when I try to do something, I better get 0.6. If I get anything else, I would not really be very happy about it because I really want to know what's going on, okay? And then the statements I want to make, of course, is the equivalent statement being made by Schneider, although you can see that Schneider made even stronger statement. You saw him made that this is not only 20th century change that is being important. It's basically the warmest in 1,000 years or 2,000 years. Okay. With that, if you're still wondering, I really wanted to point to you, this is the way they make their statement. This is how it came about. So it needs a proper introduction. The proper introduction is as such, okay, that we are really looking at the 20th century, okay, that is extremely warm compared to any of the information that one sees here. Okay. This is actually the very, very famous thing that people call the temperature hockey stick. It is supposed to represent the northern hemisphere temperature that's been measured from 1,000 years to 2,000, year 1,000 to 2,000. Okay. These are all the temperature records that one can average, okay, basically based on the climate, indirect climate measurements. It's the proxy like tree rings and lake sediments and ocean sediment that Sally really introduced very well on. And then you got this instrumental data that I show you, 140 years of instrumental data that got tagged on to the proxy data. So essentially, one is looking at this portion, which is the 20th century, where I will focus on. It's the blade. And then you got this shaft, which is really, really a flat part, where you would not expect that one hardly see any possibility for little ice age there, except maybe for that one little dip. But little ice age is a much persistent phenomenon that happened basically for about 600 years. Here you got one small little dip, so it really doesn't count. And then, of course, year 1000, one hardly see any medieval warm period, which is very well known in historical records. And actually, a lot of this proxy also says that. And here is now another way of looking at this. And I borrowed this graph from my very dear colleague from University of Delaware, but his name is David Legates. He's really a fine person to work with, and Sally and I work with him quite a lot. And then I borrowed this chart from him, where we both testified actually last year, July 29, 2003, in Senator Inhofe committee, and where me, Legates, and then Michael Mann, the other professor who produced this chart, was sitting there. And then Dave was really insisting on bringing a hockey stick to the testimony. I say, "Hey, Dave, better don't bring this. They will not let you into the Senate hall." So by substitute, we could have to produce this particular chart to show you. This is where the shaft is. This is the blade. And then, of course, I forgot to tell you, the cover is also not true, which means I don't believe in any of these results. This is, quote-unquote, the uncertainty error bars, okay? This cover, basically a cover for the sheet. It's really based on very, very poor statistics and poor understanding of how variability works and how nature really, really works. By the way, there's not only one hockey stick, of course. One can also try to... And then another important point to understand. why are they really are so anxious to try to produce a temperature record that really looked like a hockey stick, meaning the 20th century got to be so special. Essentially, they want to produce a boomerang, actually, because it will be much, much warmer up. So now, for now, we're looking at only hockey stick. Okay? But the main reason why they keep talking about these hockey sticks is basically they knew, this is at least the official chart from IPCC, which is the United Nations body, they really have an equivalent of all the evil gases like CO2, CH4, and N2O. These are all the so-called greenhouse gases. Essentially, they think that they can get information from the ice core, and then they can produce something where nothing changed for 1,000 years, and then boom, they got this very, very high end. So they have an equivalent of the hockey sticks. This is why they are so anxious, extremely anxious, to try to produce temperature record that really looks something like that. Okay? Nothing is essential for this 900 years, and then last 100 years, something very, very special happened, simply because human has been really using a lot of the fossil fuel and then been letting some of this CO2 out. But unfortunately, the question is a lot more complicated than that. Okay? You just simply cannot, and this is part of my rationale for understanding why this curve came about. And I want to tell you, based on my own papers with Sally and David Legates and then the Itso brothers from Arizona, we really, really, last year we have addressed the whole paper is extremely long, actually about 60 pages. We try to collect all the evidence from all over the world and then try to see whether the reality of medieval warm was there or the little ice age was there. We really come up to a point that, yes, these are real phenomena. One really see it all over the world. Okay? Although they are not happening at the same time, meaning the medieval warm period in China may be slightly different from South America, but then indeed overall one can see such a picture, such a trend, okay, from those indirect proxy like tree rings, ice core, and all those good stuff that one really can see that. But unfortunately, you can see it's not represented in this official record. Okay? And then, now let me move on. There is not only one hockey stick, as you know. There's about four or five of them around. That's basically used a similar kind of data and it's been published all over the place. This is indeed the main focus of this section of the talk on dangerous fiction. I'm just showing you four specific records. This one is from the IPCC. Okay? And then the area that we're focusing on is not, of course, this area. We're focusing on the 20th century change, the shaft. Okay? This is the instrumental data. By the way, this instrumental data, as I say, if you're really interested in CO2, you need to look at it from a wrong time scale. So one really cannot make no sense to try to plot the year-to-year changes. So one smooth it out using a filter of some kind, a low-pass filter. So one can, for example, the canonical way of doing it is to pick 40 years, okay? Meaning you look at 40 years averages, differences between two times so that one can see whether there's warming or cooling trend. But so these are basically all the curves that pointing to the end, okay? And I'm showing you four or five different versions of this particular chart. And I don't know if any of you catch anything from this chart, but maybe not, it's too small. So now let's zoom in on three of the charts. This is the chart that really caught our attention. So do you see it? This is basically a comparison of the charts that I just showed you. Paper again published by Professor Mann and his colleague. In 2002, 2003, and less than a month later, guess what happened? Look at the progressive increase of the endpoint. Okay. No, and think about it. This is very serious, laughing aside. What really happens during this short time, short period? Did nature really change that much that one can all of a sudden get such a high end at the point? The bottom line, of course, is as I say in my paper that was published. And by the way, that paper was trying to be... I tried to publish this paper in a journal called Geophysical Research Letter. It was reviewed, it was accepted, and it's fine. And then basically all the reviewers saying that this paper is scientifically defensible. That's exactly what Caris Mulli's statement is about. Okay? When you make a statement, you need to be able to verify it, and then meaning that we can always verify this, we'll be willing to share all the results and all the things that we do with them, with anybody who wants to know, including you or anybody. Okay? But the problem is that I'm facing with a situation in which that we could not figure out why is this temperature now so warm all of a sudden. Okay? Maybe simply because this guy, Michael Mann, is just angry at us. actually. Oh, yes. By the way, this paper was written because of our paper was written, and he got really angry, so he published something really quick. Just, there's no new information came in the climate temperature record. Okay, he basically have a paper that has been published for several years, for the past 1,000 years. Then, of course, he saw our paper, and then he got extremely unangry, very angry, and then he worked with some of these British climatologists, which is also very famous. I'm really nobody in this issue. I just wanted to know what the answer is. And this guy, they wrote a paper together that basically make the statement that Stephen Schneider quoted, that the 20th century is not only the warmest in the last 1,000 years, it's warmest for the last 2,000 years. And that's the basis for that paper. And guess, of course, the warming is extremely warm at the very end of it, which I want to prove to you that this is really something that I cannot explain, and no one in the world can replicate these things. I'm very confident of that. Which is why, of course, we publish a paper on this. Okay. So, let me try to tell you the issues that we wanted to address here. The very first one is really, really simple. If one talk about temperature, one really ought to know what is really warm or what is really cold. This is really basic. Nothing controversial, and one ought to know really what one means when one says cold or warm. Okay? And then the second point is basically trying to make the conclusion for you. I will show to you that we were very successful in basically repeating the calculation by many people, some of it including Michael Mann's old results. We were very successful in replicating that. So science is okay in that level. Science is working in the most universal and very, very simple way, you know, instead of just playing tricks and all kinds of stuff. But we honestly could not reproduce two temperature record. And I'll show you some of the problems in this record. It's basically one of the records coming from the United Nations report, which is, by the way, supplied by Professor Michael Mann, so I have to do a lot of kind of a non-scientific work to try to check out who produced that particular chart, which is that figure from IPCC. It's really important because this is a report that is supposed to be endorsed by all the nations in the world. Okay, so one ought to really have extremely high quality or trust about that kind of report when it makes statements. So I want to show you that something that is really appalling, that we could not repeat that calculation. And then there is, of course, the Mann and Jones paper, which was published in a rush, in my opinion. And we could not repeat that very high rise at the end of it. Okay? And then finally, there is a really important point to tell you, which I will show you in detail, of course. Although we were very successful in calculating, you know, repeating some of the calculation, what we found out is that, of course, there is a problem in all those calculations. What they did is essentially do something called data padding. Okay? I will spend just 1 minute to try to explain what that is. Even though you can recover that, but I'm not very happy. I'm just don't care about the result. Big deal, okay? The problem is that when you have an annual temperature record, right, you have year-to-year changes from 1850 to about 2002, 2003. Then if one want to look for the CO2 signature, one look for the long-term trend. So you can apply a filter to try to smooth this out. Okay? But the problem, of course, the standard thinking is basically you use a running averages. Okay? You start going over this record, you know, you take a 40-year chunk from the beginning, you take an average, and then you put it at a center point. Okay? And then you keep moving up year by year so you can get some very smooth feature. So in 1980, for example, if you want a value at 1980, you will need data from 1960 to about 2000. So you basically use out all your data already, almost, right? Then you take the average and then you put a point right there in 1980. Then if one need 1982, one go 2002 and then 1962. So average and put a point over there. So if you go any further, you will have to rely on some information that doesn't exist anymore. This is where fiction came about. And we found out that actually these are also statements made officially in the IPCC report, okay? That they actually, here's what they did. To present the data, because they're very anxious to show this, the most recent result, we have the most exciting result, recent result, they have to add in additional data. So to get the value at 2000, they basically have to get data from 1980, because you want to look at the 40 years average, so 1980 to 2020. So you have about that much, half of the data is missing. And guess what they do with the half of the data? They basically take you know, of course, this one, if it's just in the academic exercise, then I say it's fine. So they will just say, well, we take some average of the past 20 years. That sounds reasonable, right? And then you can do a lot of sophisticated mathematics, okay? You can do this inflection point, whatever you call it, okay? To me, you're still using information from something which doesn't exist. This is what's called data padding. By the way, he was very angry after we wrote this paper. He was really even more angry, so he has another paper out there criticizing how bad we were again. Okay, that we are so stupid. Actually, essentially, the word is stupid. We don't even know what method he used, blah, blah, blah. So if you have one of those articles that I just put out this morning, please read it, because in there I document a lot of the problems in terms of this personal level, things that he was trying to disgrace me, actually, and people like Sally, too. You know, about all of us, he was saying we're just, you know, really dumb and doesn't know what we're doing, and really very, very bad for pointing this out. But then we have a duty, really, to try to tell what is the real numbers, what is it supposed to be. So here's what we did. That is the running. Here's I'm showing you some of the techniques that we can do to try to get about the running averages, okay? Again, you got the blue line, which is the year-to-year changes. Even though I don't really believe in the record in the first place. Remember, I say that I don't trust some of these numbers here, because simply the sampling is very bad. One really cannot call this a global or northern hemisphere average temperature. But we'll play the game, okay? But the panel A is basically the most conservative statement you can make about long-term temperature trend. Because you have a record from 1850 to about 2002, the most you can make, the most conservative statement is you can make is any changes of the trend line from about 1880 to about 1980 or so. And that's it. And then you don't make any more statement, because all this tendency of where the temperature go, or else you basically claim that you know what the future temperature is going to be. Then what's the point of studying? There's no point of doing any research anymore, really. And then that's why I stopped that. This is just for illustration. And then this is the part where the IPCC and then Professor Mann himself also have actually added additional data from 2001 to about 2020. And then this is where I'm trying to show you some of the sensitivity of what you assume for the future values. Okay? And then one can do very, very sophisticated mathematics. This one we use a wavelet transform. Okay? One can try to pull out this filtering. But then what the lesson here is indeed that this method, even though he can agree or disagree, you can say any methods you want, the problem is that even though a method can be claimed to objective, but the application of it is really subjective. Because you are dealing with real life here. You really cannot really do things like this, that you add in additional data that don't exist. Okay? And which really, really come to another point, this quote that I really like very much. Again, Karimullis is my hero here. Well, he really was maybe even anticipating that movie, that famous movie that just came out in the summer, Day After Tomorrow, right? He was really talking about this movie critics too. And he really said that we really, really has to be very, very careful when we make a statement. And he really, really explained very well what science is, okay? Well, he talked about Newton, so we ignore it. That's okay. I'm sorry. Newton is a good guy, but really, it's about what Newton found. It has nothing to do with who Newton is or what Newton is. This is part of the reason why I say I'm not here to criticize Professor Mann. I'm just criticizing his results, actually. Okay? And I don't like him very much, that's for sure. And this is where he really, really makes the point that you really, really, one of the basic scientific tenets, okay, would be replication. One ought to be able to make replication. That is what I want to assure you, that if you cannot do that, please, you know, don't disturb anyone about this. All right? You cannot just make your own opinion or just by angry writing another papers where nobody can track you, okay? And now I just want to prove to you the quality of why I say that I cannot replicate two of the results. I want to prove to you some of the results that we can replicate. Okay? So we're not just out there to get people and all that stuff has no scientific basis or whatsoever. Here's one of the successful replication. This is one of the chart in IPCC. And guess what? This chart is not produced by Professor Mann. Okay? Professor Mann is the one that I cannot reproduce. This is a chart produced by basically Chris Follen, somebody from the UK Meteorological Office. Okay? This is their chart. This is our chart. We are able to really simulate that very well. We can replicate that quite well. Here's one that will give a lot of headache to Professor Mann for the claim. This is a chart that also based on Professor Mann's and Professor Phil Jones' paper. Okay? But it is a chart that is very different from the one that I cannot replicate. The one that I cannot replicate is for Northern Hemisphere. Okay? But the one for the Southern Hemisphere, even though I don't believe in any of this result, I'm focusing on only smoothing the temperature trend, the instrumental temperature trend. So I was able to get that thing more or less, and the end of it was not exaggerated, put it that way, 0.2, 0.3 Celsius. Okay? So I'm able to do it. So if he were to say that, well, you know, I may have did some tricks and all that, but then I was able to produce something in his paper. But I cannot produce the 20th century, the one for Northern Hemisphere. That really, really tells me that I caught him on something that very strange that he did. I have no idea what he did, but I don't want to speculate on that because no point. And the way he defends it, oh, he has used objective method. That is standard. We just simply don't know how to do it. I just always would challenge him, you know, please, you know, tell me what method you use. Anything you do, I can do. Okay? And he was just really, really very arrogant about this whole thing and extremely difficult to work with. So here's another successful replication. This one done by Professor Phil Jones, independent of Professor Mant. Okay? He has a instrumental temperature record that shows the one of the results is basically Southern Hemisphere 2, summer temperature. I took one of his original and then I tried to recalculate. It's the black line. See, we got the shape, we got the more or less the same. So there's no problem there. And then here's one more. By the way, I will stop doing this. This is the last one. But this one makes another very important point. This one, I was able to recover Professor Mann's own results that published in Science. Okay, but I do it in a very special way. I do it instead of using any of my method. I don't even want to do this, actually. I asked my friend at MathWork, the guy who produced MATLAB. Okay, I asked him, Dallas Kennedy. He's a very, very smart physicist. He's actually a particle physicist. I tell him to go and do this for me. So I don't have to do it. I'm outside of this whole thing. And guess what we can do? We can really, really get what he gets using Professor Mann's computer program itself. Okay, so we got no problem there. But now, to bring it home, this is a curve we can never produce. Okay. He essentially had to do a lot of tricks, basically adding a lot of data is very high at the end of it. Essentially, if you think about one way of doing it. But of course, you know that really you call it a cheat or something. I don't know what word to use for that. So, one more time. Let me summarize. We'll move on to the fun part very soon. That was not very fun, actually. Very unpleasant experience for doing this. But unfortunately, I felt that I'm, as a scientist, this one was completely unfunded. You know, we all do it on our own free time, Sally and us and the Gates. We just suddenly thought that we really have to write this paper. And this paper appeared on Valentine's Day, maybe by the arrangement, actually by the arrangement of Professor Mann itself, if you want to know the inside story. The paper was supposed to appear 2.5 weeks earlier. And then when the paper didn't come out, I was very surprised. I said, what's going on? So I called the office, and then they said, well, you know, there's a problem with your paper. You have used a lot of the chart that's been previously published by someone else. They don't mention my name, of course. And then they claim that there is a copyright violation. And I can tell you we were smart this time around because I had a very bad experience with him a year ago. So we already got all the permission from the publisher. And in fact, some of it I even told it to the editor who's in charge. We already have it before we even send the manuscript for review. So essentially, and then in the end, when we resolve everything, guess what the production person from the GRL told me? That, oh, thank you very much for resolving this, and we really should not have taken Michael Mann's word for it. So guess who is behind the scene trying to stop even publishing a really normal scientific paper who has really forced no threat to no one, okay? It's just simply trying to make a statement. But the statement is that we cannot replicate two of these important results. One is in the IPCC document. One is in Professor Mann's own publication. And here, we have to come back to our anti-hero here, which is Stephen Schneider. He has made a very, very famous statement. Of course, you know, the reason why I have to put this up is because now I'm leading into the part where I'm talking about spin. The very, very famous spin that he has made, really talking about the confusion about being a scientist and a human being, okay? He basically is trying to say that, well, you know, you be a scientist, you got to tell everything the truth, but nothing but the truth. And then, but for people, we really like to see the world as a better place. And this really, to him, translates into working to reduce risk. Okay, that's very fine, actually good statement. But to do that, we need to get some broad-based support. to capture public imagination. That's where all the spin come about. That, of course, means getting loads of media coverage. And we have to offer up scary scenario. Maybe there's a link there. You know, of the high temperature. Make simplify and dramatic statement and make little mention of any doubt we have. And guess what? He even have a term for such a dilemma for him. That he call it double ethical blind. Okay? That we have to balance between effective and being honest. I really resent that statement as if that he's really intellectually honest. I really felt that we can be both effective and honest at the same time. There's nothing to choose. There's really nothing to choose for those younger person in this crowd here. I really was also coming from a person who doesn't know anything about climate, and I've been studying this for about 5-10 years. And I really think that there is nothing to choose here. If you have a statement, you make it accurately and you make it as best as you can. If you make an error, of course, admit it. Okay? And you will see Professor Mann beginning to admit some of his error now, at the end of it. But now I want to show you the kind of spin that is really, really bad. Okay? This is the curve that basically, if you ask me to repeat, I can repeat. Because this is a curve basically produced by the UN report. Okay? That was less than basically 6 months or 8 months, okay, before the final publication. Before the final publication, the instrumental curve was actually at 0.3 at the end of it. And then the actual final publication, there was this extra 0.1. These are not matter of ink, it's not anything, it's just matter of really something. They did something to try to make the temperature go up a little bit. So you can see, right, during the peer review process, they show everybody this results. During the final process, they show one that is much warmer. Okay? When nobody was looking at the final review report. But then, of course, we got this pre-publication and the final publication. Now there's something even more obvious about what Professor Mann has done in terms of the results that I cannot recover. I want to show you first this chart. This is the same chart that I claim that I cannot recover, which is a result of Northern Hemisphere for the last 2,000 years, but I don't want to recover this. I want to recover this particular instrumental trend. Look, at year 2000, it was very nice. It was 0.2. Okay, it was not that 0.55 that one can get. But I want to show you the next chart that I want to be careful, and then and look carefully at this cover, what they call the hockey stick cover, which is the yellow bar. They call it uncertainty bar. And guess what? This is the uncertainty bar that is basically plus or minus 1 sigma. And then the instrumental result was okay, was no need to be that high. I even caught him to have a chart like this. This is his final publication. His final publication is that he has to increase at 2 sigma because, you know why? He published Northern Hemisphere, Southern Hemisphere, and Globe. For the Southern Hemisphere and Globe, he produced 2 sigma chart and then produced the instrumental data. Okay? And then for the Northern Hemisphere, he first did it with 1 sigma for the Northern Hemisphere. And then for the final publication, to make it consistent with Southern Hemisphere and global temperature, he do the Northern Hemisphere double 2 sigma, and then guess what happened to the instrumental data? Okay, one more time in case you don't get it. Because this is really, really very, very bad. Really terrible spin in what I say to be a spin. See, the bottom here, you're only up to 0.2, and then you have 1 sigma error bar. And then when you really need to be consistent with everything else, you do 2 sigma, but then all of a sudden, your temperature really, really gets very, very high. And something very, very strange, of course, because all these things happen in less than 1 month. Less than 1 month. This was the version that they sent for people to review. Okay? For Geophysical Research Letter, the same journal that we published. They sent for review, he showed this. And then for the final paper, this is what the outcome is. And I really think that that's terrible. And then now let's get back to something even more strange. Okay, if you want spin, I have 10 minutes, okay, fine. This is even more spin. So I won't cover all my spins, but I'll show you this one last spin. And it's by a very famous person, of course, Stephen Schneider. Okay. I want to show you a chart that he borrowed from Mann and Jones, he says. Okay? And this is for his testimony. This is a draft version that he submitted to Senator McCain committee. Of course, that same statement about 0.6 since 1860, right? And clearly discerned by just plotting it. Okay? So brilliant. But then there's a lot of problem in this particular presentation. He has the word that says that it's 0.6, but then he has used a chart that shows that it's 0.8, okay, for the temperature. So really like he put a draft there so, you know, he can get away by really doing something, okay? So you see the temperature here is 0.8, so it's really inconsistent with his words, okay? He said, you just look at this figure 2, you will understand. So guess what happened? He now asked Professor Mann for a small little rescue. So he go back and use the old graph. Okay? Now it's 0.6. Okay, now it makes sense with him. Okay? And then, by the way, there was another problem. You see this chart here? Sorry for the poor production. That proxy data stopped at 1980. Okay? It's not all the way up to that. And then Professor Mann and his colleague claimed that, well, you know, proxy data, you know, all this indirect proxy don't have information to 2000. That's not true, of course, you know, that we have all that information. So now, not only that this temperature change, the instrumental data, but they actually have the proxy data match it. Looks really, really impressive. Okay? So in this chart, this is the final version that Schneider submitted. Okay? That he can show that it's 0.6 changes, global temperature, so agree with him. And then now the proxy and the instrumental looks really good. They agree with each other in some sense, except for the dip there, even though it's still not impressive to me. But Professor Schneider really have a lot more problem than that. The problem is that Michael Mann changed his mind again. This is another paper that just published last month. And look at now what happened. Even though now you agree, but then Professor Mann decided to put the temperature up again. Okay? So, really, really, that we are really looking at a problem that is very intractable. It's extremely complicated. And since I'm really out of time, I do have one something very interesting to show, but I think I won't show it, but it's just a controversy that that Michael Mann get involved with while he was not only dealing with us, he's dealing with so many other people from other fields. For example, he had a real problem with people from borehole temperature community. The problem is this. I can do it really quick. This is the temperature reconstruction history for the last 500 years. The upper curve is basically what is produced by Professor Mann and bunch of his colleagues. And then these are the curves that are produced by people from the borehole community. So you can see that his temperature is not cooler. During his little ice age, it's not as cool as this guy by actually 0.4C. By the way, that number is very, very important because it's a big difference between these two. So, but actually, a lot of by this time, all of us know that the way you resolve this is simply by saying that because his temperature record was based a lot on tree rings, and tree rings don't have information on centennial changes, one would be very happy to say that, well, simply because his result doesn't include these centennial and multi-decadal changes. But no, not for Michael Mann. He cannot make any mistakes. He basically say that, wow, those borehole guys doesn't know what they're doing. They calculate something wrong. Okay? And then he used a computer model to try to dream out his theory. Basically, I can tell you, this is a non-problem, and he created a problem, and then he provide a non-solution. Here's the non-solution. He say that, well, maybe the problem of the difference is because, well, the snow cover has been blocking the heat going down to the ground, because borehole is about drilling down to the ground and measure the thermal properties and then try to recover the information with time or with depth, right, of how the changes go, the heat flows. So he basically said that, well, during warm season, one can see that the ground temperature and the air temperature agree very well, but then the ground temperature and the air temperature during cold season doesn't agree as well, okay? He somehow artificially split that based on a model results, okay? That you know that computer model really doesn't know anything about the land surfaces, really. And then, but then he used such a result, and then guess what he did? He did something very, very bad. He picked the one particular year, 1971 and 1998. He picked 2 points. And then he computed the difference of the air temperature, he got 2.66, and then the ground temperature, he got 2.48. And then he said, well, that's true. Now we can show that the air temperature is warmer than the ground temperature, 0.2 degree by 0.2 degree. But then the commentator on this paper, which is some of the geologists from University of Utah, they quickly point out that, wow, this is very dangerous. You are trying to... He essentially did this, right? He picked a single point. Okay? Oops. He picked a single point to try to make the claim that he did. He picked 71 and then 1998. But if you really want to study the difference between the ground temperature and air temperature for long-term basis, for borehole, you really would fit a trend here. Basically, the trend of these two curves, either ground or air, doesn't differ that much. It's almost exactly the same as you can see, produced from this bottom analysis. Basically, air temperature give you a trend of 0.6, and then basically ground temperature give you 0.6. But instead, he picked the individual point, and then he computed the difference to try to prove his hypothesis. Do you get it? That is the problem with this kind of result. Plus that this is where the comments that is very, very interesting and is published officially. It's talking about bad science produced by these folks, including Michael Mann. So I think with that, I better stop. And I have no more conclusion to make. By the way, oh, there's one more interesting thing. This is what I mean by a non-solution to a non-problem. This is a paper that I just published about 2 weeks ago. That actually he published an errata. This is dealing with another issue, but it proved to you the quality of the work produced by this person is very, very confusing. So he started to admit all kinds of things about his error, and then he hasn't included this in his computer program. Now, but anyway, it's extremely difficult to find him write something like this, which is basically admitting that he got a lot of problem in his borehole temperature calculation. Okay, and that's very valuable. And then my basic conclusion is basically this particular chart that I borrowed from my friend David Legates. You really cannot make that statement, X, essentially. To say that 20th century is the warmest of the 2,000 years or 1,000 years, or 1990 1990 as a decade, or 1998 as a single year. Simply because that we really don't have that much of information for the full period. But we know that medieval warm period is pretty robust as a feature. Meaning 1,000 years ago, you can find, you know, generally warm condition, maybe a little bit drier in mid America, and then a little bit wetter in India. So, but then one can see such a general condition prevailing throughout the whole globe, from northern hemisphere to southern hemisphere. And so, but then to come to make a statement to say that, well, you know, 20th century is the warmest of all warm, you're really, really violating the actual observational results. Although there's much work to be done, but I really felt that he really, really missed the point. And plus that, remember, temperature, there's no sense of really talking about global temperature all the time. Remember, there's no single temperature of global temperature, or not a single temperature for the northern hemisphere. The really, really relevant one is really this local and regional temperature that one ought to look at. Okay? And that's where we live. Thank you.
Enjoyed tremendously your presentation. I was wondering if I was looking at the documentary movie of Michael Moore.
Okay.
I think where you need to look to answer to your question is in the motivation. Humans do things for a certain reason.
Okay.
There cannot be a coincidence that the movie comes out at the same time as IPCC and this truncated information. So the motivation behind it is create fear to change something drastic in our economy. And the answer is both economic and political, is to get the Western world to be independent from another part of the world, which controls presently a tremendous asset of energy resources. And unless we find a motivation to get to move into alternative energies, we are going to be in big trouble. Your study is absolutely, perfectly, scientifically correct. What is missing in your analysis is the motivation, which goes far beyond Dr. Mann, Dr. Schneider. You have to look much further into the economic and political motivation for such deception.
I'm speechless. Well, anyway, good enough. No. I want to make a comment. But as a scientist, the first, very first start, I have to do what I do first. And that's under a lot of heat. Okay? In fact, I'm going to leave the field. I'm not going to do this anymore. I always say that this is the very unfinished business that I have to do. I really will move on because it's just a waste of my time. Excuse me. It's really a waste of my time to listen to Stephen Schneider for his political whatever motivation that he has, because they essentially tell a lot of lies. That's terrible. And I'm not Michael Moore. I hate Michael Moore.